This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. One of the world's top movies right now is Ready Player One, the latest film by Steven Spielberg. The sci-fi smash explores how our relationship with machines is changing, including through a highly immersive virtual world. Ready Player One opens in the year 2045. The Earth is almost uninhabitable, and humans are turning to a virtual world over the real one.
Sitting here in my tiny corner of nowhere, there's nowhere left to go. Nowhere. Except the Oasis. A whole virtual universe.
Let me take you on a trip around the world and back.
People come to the Oasis for all the things they can do.
And you won't have to really sit still.
But they stay because of all the things they can be.
That's Hollywood's latest take on VR, but there is so much more to consider beyond its profound ability to entertain. Today we'll meet someone who's been studying VR for 20 years. What has he learned? We'll ask him just after this.
Support for NPR and the following message come from the NPR Wine Club. Discover hand-selected wines from award-winning vineyards around the world. Learn the stories behind each one and enjoy unique bottles inspired by your favorite NPR shows, like Weekend Edition, all with the convenience of home delivery. A special welcome offer includes a bottle of Weekend Edition Cabernet Sauvignon. If you're 21 years or older, join in the fun at nprwineclub.org/1A.
Planet Money tip number 17. Sometimes the most important things need a hype squad.
Corporate.
Income.
Tax.
Corporate income tax!
Planet Money, a podcast about the economy. A very enthusiastic podcast about the economy.
Stanford professor Jeremy Bailenson leads the university's Virtual Human Interaction Lab. For 20 years, he has been studying how people can and will communicate in a virtual world. Now, the chances are you probably don't have a VR headset, which may be a good thing, because Professor Bailenson has strong views about why spending hours under those goggles is a really bad idea. However, his work has also led him to discover how VR could encourage us to eat less, to help the homeless, or to get along better with people of different races, gender, or ages. His new book is called Experience on Demand: What Virtual Reality Is, How It Works, and What It Can Do. Professor Bailenson, welcome to 1A.
Joshua, thank you for having me.
When was the first time that virtual reality captivated you? Take me back to the moment you fell in love with it.
The moment I tried VR first was back in 1994. I was interviewing to be a PhD student at Berkeley and had a free day, and I was walking along the Embarcadero and I found an arcade that basically you waited online and you paid $25 and I got to play this video game called Dactyl Nightmare. And for those of you that had tried VR now, imagine the 1994 version. It's very low update rates and a little bit jaggy in terms of the graphics and, you know, broke down a couple of times, but even though that experience was you know, pretty painful at times with the technology not working, it still inspired me to say, wow, this is something completely different than other media, and what a mind-blowing experience.
Was there anything in particular about it that hooked you? Was it the feel of it, the look of it, the potential? What did you see in it then?
I mean, for me, what makes VR special and what captured me then is this aspect of complete mental transportation. It's like you're there. And so if you fast forward to the year 1999, when I was interviewing to be a postdoc at UC Santa Barbara, my first high-end VR experience was one of my professors there, Jack Loomis, he put the goggles on my head and I walked around and saw that the virtual room I was in looked just like the physical room and it felt like I was walking around. And then he hit a button and he dropped what we call the pit, this 10-meter deep chasm that right in the middle of the room, and he put a little plank over that chasm. And you know, when I took a step forward in the physical room, I got closer to that plank in the virtual room, and that was the moment that I knew that VR was really a medium that was just fundamentally mind-blowing and really could be used to change the way people think. I couldn't step off that plank. It was an extremely powerful illusion.
Let's talk a little bit more about some of the nuts and bolts behind VR, so to speak. There are three terms that you break down early in the book that are key to understanding how VR works: tracking, rendering, and display. I think for anyone who's ever used VR, and I will disclose off the top, I own a VR system, I own a PlayStation 4 Pro, and I have the PlayStation VR set, and I love it, and I don't care what anybody thinks. But I think for anybody who owns a VR system, these three things are what can make a VR experience either awesome or awful. So why don't you define these three terms: tracking, rendering, and display.
Yes, I'm happy to, but we're going to have to get back to what your favorite VR game is and what you've been doing. I'm so thrilled to hear you do VR at home. That's fantastic.
I do. Well, look, I haven't in a while because I work in Washington and DC's busy these days, so I haven't hooked up my system in a while. But what am I playing? I finished Archangel, which was phenomenal. I love Tumble VR, which is good for kind of slowing my brain down. Darknet is good for speeding my brain up. And the VR minigame in Star Wars Battlefront is awesome. I don't do haunted houses. I don't do killer clowns jumping out of the dark because I don't feel like peeing on myself. But other than that, like the fun games, the shoot 'em up games, puzzle games, flying games, those are all cool with me.
Okay. I just hosted the team from Sony in my lab about 2 weeks ago, and they suggested Mouse, which I have yet to do, but I'm excited to try that one. But tracking, rendering, and display. This is the bread and butter of VR. So what makes VR different from other media is two kind of general principles. And for people that have never done VR, I say instead of watching a movie, it's as if you're in a movie. And to break that down a bit further, the two things that makes VR different is that it responds to your body movement. So the way that you interact with content is you walk towards it, or you look at it, or you reach out your hand and touch it. That's number one. The second is that it's perceptually surrounding. When you watch a movie, if you turn your head away, you don't see it. In VR, it's always there with images that are drawn wherever you look, and spatialized sound and touch. And the terms tracking, rendering, and display are fancy words for tracking. Simply means measuring your physical movement. So in the physical room, there's sensors, and the sensors detect if you took a step forward, if you turned your head to the left, if you pointed your hand towards something. The next phase is called rendering, and what rendering means is it's not possible to store every possible viewpoint, every sight and sound and touch for every possible location in a game or in a VR scene. Hence, what we have to do is, from an abstract mathematical model, we have to instantiate the viewpoint. So if you take a step forward, we've got to draw the wall a little bigger that you walk towards. If you turn your head to the left and there's a sound source over there, the sound's got to get louder. Every time we track your movement, we then render or recreate the sight, sound, and touch, and sometimes smell for that new location. The final phase is display, and that is showing the eyes, replacing the sound for the ears, and giving feedback to the skin. That's the idea of, we've tracked the movement in the physical world, we've recreated the sight, sound, and touch for the new location, and now you've got to send those sights to the eyes with the goggles, send those sounds to the ears with earphones or an array of speakers, and then send touch to the skin with different types of what's called haptic devices.
So tracking, rendering, display are basically, it sounds like, the way that you put somebody's head and possibly hands inside a VR experience and have the computer treat our display and our perception as if we were inside the program.
So for users of VR, what I like to say is all those terms go away. You just have an experience, and you're walking around it, and you're interacting with objects, and the brain treats it as if you were there. To make that happen, you've got to track the physical movements, redraw the right senses for that new location, and then replace what the body is receiving via the senses.
Part of what we wanted to discuss with you this hour was the potential for VR to be something more than an amusement. Of course, the amusement is awesome, but there's much more potential to it than that. You write in the book, quote, "For me, the most exciting art of VR is its potential to democratize learning and training," unquote. When did you first see us begin to turn that corner towards more, I don't want to say practical, maybe more professional or more societal applications of VR? Is this more recent, or is this something that has always been part of the big dream for VR?
When you think about the history of virtual reality, and this is, it begins with Ivan Sutherland writing a really seminal piece in the late 1960s, and the amazing work from Jaron Lanier in the, you know, with VPL in the late 80s, early 90s, the work of Mel Slater at University College London, UNC Chapel Hill, in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, when we thought about VR, we being, you know, these are my mentors and the field. Entertainment, watching movies, video games, this really was not on people's radar. I mean, you know, VR used to be, and when I say used to be, as early as 2012, 2013, think of it like an MRI machine, a magnetic resonance imaging machine. Really expensive, six figures, seven figures sometimes, takes up a big part of the room. You need an engineer to run it. Hence, because it was this very, you know, intense machinery that you couldn't even imagine operating at home, watching a movie or playing a video game wasn't even on our radar early on. It was, let's use this to train surgeons. Let's use this to treat people who've got conditions that are hard to treat otherwise. Let's use this to teach someone about something that they couldn't do in a classroom. The entertainment wasn't really on our radar. It's really in the last five-ish years that the video game idea and the Hollywood industry and journalism is starting to think about the medium. So when you go back in history of VR, it was always about really special cases that you couldn't do otherwise. So that's as a field. My personal narrative is when I arrive at Stanford in 2003, I set up this virtual reality lab, and we do a lot of work in the lab about communication and understanding avatars, which is this representation of you that you discussed early on in the intro with Ready Player One. In 2010, my lab shifts. One of the big events in my life is I get tenure, and this means that you've got job security, and it really frees you to do riskier work. And
right.
It's in that moment, Joshua, that I decide I'm really going to shift towards these pro-social causes, things like climate change, issues of race and gender, etc.
Let's jump back to where we started the conversation with that movie Ready Player One, directed by Steven Spielberg. Here is a clip of Spielberg speaking to NBC's Natalie Morales about a key message he wanted to get across to younger viewers.
They get lost in the games right now. I mean, we're going through a generation where all of us, including myself, but all the kids are going to get bone spurs in their neck from looking down.
But there is a real message in the movie, and that is that the best reality is the real world. It's not the virtual world.
Well, it's what I believe in. You cannot substitute being in love and being in life with your friends and your family.
Or can you? Many of you sent us your stories about the impact VR is having on some of your friendships, including this one that was left in our inbox.
My name is Wendy from North Reading. One of my best friends spends most of his life on IMVU. That stands for Instant Message Virtual Universe. And he has created an avatar to represent himself. He goes into his IMVU world and has friends. And he actually married someone on IMVU. Those vows generalize into his real life. So he doesn't date anyone else in reality because he's married to someone on IMVU. It's just a very interesting and wild experience for me to have one of my best friends live in a different reality than I do.
Wendy, thanks very much for sharing your story. Professor Bailenson, is this cause for concern, people opting for their virtual worlds over the real ones?
So first off, let's say that, you know, my PhD is in cognitive psychology, and I like to study data. And so I'm going to try to constrain as much as I can, although I'm happy to speculate a bit, on what we know. And what we know is, and when we think about this idea of addiction to a virtual world and time spent consumed, you know, there haven't been many controlled studies on this. In other words, there's very few psychologists or communication scholars that I know that are going to randomly assign 100 people to spend 80 hours a week inside of IMVU or Second Life or High Fidelity or VR Chat, and then another control condition to not do that. So the truth is, we just don't know what the effects of this online behavior is. Now, life is about moderation, right? And in general, if one is spending, you know, a bulk of her or his time inside of a virtual world, you know, there's obviously concerns and issues to talk about. I mean, personally, you know, I choose outside of work to not spend much time in VR. I mean, I spend a bunch of time thinking about it all day at work, but you know, I when I go home, I choose not to play video games or to do social networking, and that's how I live my life. Obviously, you know, this idea of overuse is, it's something we talk about a lot in the book, and you know, we all have got theories about it. I do agree with our earlier the speaker that you gave the recording on. The real world's a great place, and we should spend time there.
Give me a I agree with that for sure, but give me a sense of some of the early impacts of VR on people who use it, play with it, experience it for the first time. I mean, I noticed, for example, the first time I hooked up my PlayStation VR rig and I started using it, I immediately had to deal with not quite motion sickness, but just a sense of a lack of real clear proprioception. Like, I didn't know exactly where my body was in space, even though I could see motion, because my body wasn't feeling motion, it was highly disorienting, and I could only play for about 15 minutes before I had to stop. Do you find that for people who try VR for the first time, is that mostly the primary impact, the physical, or are there other mental or psychological lingering impacts that kind of stick with people after they use it for the first time?
So I'm very high on VR as an amazing medium to help people get better in all sorts of ways and to have fun. That being said, there are some downsides. And Joshua, the book came out and it was reviewed by the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal and Nature, and we can go down the list. You know, people like the book in general. If there's a critique, it's that, Jeremy, you're way too optimistic and you don't talk enough about the downsides, you know, even though chapter two was all about the downsides of VR. So let's talk about that a bit. I mean, to me, the first and foremost, the thing to be careful about VR is what I call distraction. And this is when you're wearing VR, you are completely taken out of the physical world and you can't see walls. You're going to step on the cat. There's safety concerns about hitting things. And in fact, sadly, we had our first death in VR in Moscow in December. A man was playing an immersive video game, fell through a plate glass table and bled to death. So to me, the just not knowing where you are in the physical world and making sure you're not, you know, I like to joke at Stanford University and in Washington, D.C., I've seen the same thing. It seems like people's legs don't work unless their thumbs are moving. In other words, they can't walk unless they're texting. And, you know, just imagine that in VR and we're going to see that. So I distraction's my number one. My second issue, which you talk about, is simulator sickness or just a general disorientation. But I liked your answer, which was 15 minutes. And in my lab, we actually have a 20-minute rule, which is if you're in VR for 20 minutes, it's probably long enough, if not too much. If you plan on staying in longer, take the goggles off, have a drink of water, touch a wall. And, you know, what I've found, and it sounds like you maybe have a different opinion, but I haven't found any VR experience yet that's really justifies my attention for more than 15 or 20 minutes. And, you know, even the best games that I've seen are really good for a couple of minutes, but really not designed to be like typical games where you can play for longer.
Even on the PlayStation 4, it makes a little ding, like a little chime every 20 minutes to let you know that you've been playing that long and you need to take a break.
I fully support that.
Willix James tweeted, "Can VR help with racism by exposing someone to a different group and culture?" Definitely want to talk about some of the other applications of VR as we continue our conversation with Stanford professor Jeremy Bailenson. His new book is called Experience on Demand: What Virtual Reality Is, How It Works, and What It Can Do. What does the future look like for VR? And how can you get in on it? That and more of your questions just ahead. Stay close.
Support for 1A and the following message come from American Express. These days, keeping up with everything in the news is hard, whether it's politics or pop culture. American Express believes it's always easier to stay ahead when there's someone behind you. Easier to focus on what matters, to follow what interests you, to explore, to discover. And with American Express, you don't have to go it alone because they have your back. Don't live life without it.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
A fair amount of the book deals with VR and empathy. We had a question earlier about whether VR could help dispel racism by exposing someone to different groups and cultures. You've written about a number of examples where VR has been used in racial bias training. I wonder what you saw that impressed you, particularly because there is also research that says racial bias training in many cases does not work. It doesn't meet the aim that it's designed to. Where have you seen VR effective in this way?
So I'll talk about two things. One is the older research and where the foundation comes from. And the second is a new piece that we just premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival. So the early research is about something called body transfer, which is that in VR, you can literally wear the body of someone else and use neuroscience techniques to make you really feel like that body's yours. So in our first study in 2003, we had people put on the goggles, walk around the physical room, and see their virtual mirror reflection. In other words, in the goggles, they saw a mirror, and they saw their reflection, and they would move around physically and see their mirror reflection move with them. And what we did in this first study is they became older. 20-somethings became about 70 years old, and they got to experience what it's like to become older. They would then turn around in the room, and we would network in a second person into virtual reality, and that person would then treat them poorly based on their age. They would make fun of their memory, and you basically, during a job interview, you wouldn't get a job because of your age. And afterward, in that first preliminary study, we showed that people, when you look at implicit measures of ageism, they become a little bit less biased on some reaction time type measures. Now, fast forward 15 years of research, there's a great group called in Barcelona under Mel Slater that are showing that this principle of body transfer can change all sorts of bias. We've studied it as well. We just premiered, there's an amazing professor, her name is Courtney Cogburn at Columbia University, and she studies black, white, racial bias for her research agenda. We just spent the last 2 years working with, funded by the Brown Institute for Media, building a piece called Thousand Cut Journey. And this was based on Courtney's research, Professor Cogburn's research, which it was about, becoming a black male named Michael Sterling. It was about an 11-minute piece. And, Courtney really wanted not to look at explicit racism, but more implicit kind of microaggressions. And you start out as a child in a classroom, you're 6 years old, and the teacher punishes you for something that the other white kids were doing as well. You then become a teenager and experience a stop and frisk scene, whereas a white friend of yours that did a similar thing does not get that experience. And finally, you become a 30-year-old and you don't get a job because of your race. And it's a really intense piece where you feel what it's like to walk a mile in someone else's shoes. And we're really proud of that just premiered a week or two ago.
I love what you write in the book regarding VR and journalism, which I think is applicable to this as well in terms of the challenges, the ethical challenges editorially of putting one of these situations together. I could see, for example, a VR simulation about race and law enforcement looking great to me as a black man in America, right? But then to someone else who may be a law enforcement officer, regardless of their color, they might think that you have biased the information to depict a situation that they've never been in, their officers have never been in, they don't know anyone else who's involved in it. I wonder how you deal with bias in these kinds of situations, these simulations, to create empathy. Are there best practices, or are we still trying to figure this out?
So first and foremost, let me say that I work with police officers. I work with the U.S. military. I'm proud to train, law enforcement. And it's really important to get both sides of this, and 100% with you there. The answer of how to, basically not screw things up, because, this is a powerful medium, is just to be careful and to be slow and to study it. So with Thousand Cut Journey, we have not yet released this to the public. So with most of my lab's content, we've got Becoming Homeless, as you mentioned earlier, about our journey where you become homeless. We've got the Stanford Ocean Acidification Experience, where you see the future of the oceans of climate change. We give those away for free on Steam, on Viveport, on Oculus Share. Anyone can download those because we have studied those extensively.
I'm sorry, Steam, Viveport, and Oculus Share, what are those?
Seth, Steam, Viveport, and Oculus Share, I'm trying to be fair to all the companies here, are places where you can, it's the iTunes of VR experiences.
Gotcha.
Except we're not selling these, we're just giving them away. So I'm not plugging anything other than free VR educational content. The reason those are free online is because we have studied those extensively, and I'm fairly confident that, you know, in the absolute worst case, they only work a little bit in terms of helping educate you about these. Most likely, we're pretty confident that they do. With Thousand Cut Journey, because this is some serious content, Courtney and I and our colleagues are now starting to study this extensively, how it changes attitudes, and we're going to be careful and slow on this.
I should also note there are some free VR experiences on PlayStation 4 as well, including one from the U.S. Air Force that lets you practice a halo jump, a high-altitude, low-oxygen jump. It's called Nightfall, Air Force Special Ops Nightfall. Anthony tweeted, "I just don't get why folks see VR as a panacea. Racism in the real world needs to be addressed there. Why the push to remove the human touch from healthcare? VR seems dehumanizing." Professor, I take Anthony's point. I wonder how we prevent it from being dehumanizing.
Yeah, and in fact, one of my talking points, which I've neglected to say in this interview, so thank you, Anthony, is that I do not think any medium, any singular experience is going to solve these really difficult problems. VR, when it comes to racism, is a tool, and it's something that we can use for, you know, Thousand Cut Journey took us, no exaggeration, Joshua, you know, 2 years and 2,000 hours and great funding from the Brown Institute. It took us a long time, and it's only 11 minutes. We're not solving the world's problems there, but it is a tool. And it's, the way I think about VR with racism diversity training is you go in the goggles, you have this experience, and it changes you emotionally. And then you go back and you talk with your colleagues and you do the typical training. It doesn't replace that. It's just another tool to help. So not a panacea, not solving the world's problems, but it is a neat tool that we found is more powerful than other media based on how it responds to your body and is so perceptually immersive.
We got a number of stories from you about how profoundly a VR experience affected you, changed your behavior, helped you deal with a trauma. Thank you for sharing all these stories. One listener sent us a story about how VR led her to eat differently. Here's the message she left in our inbox.
Hello, my name is Deirdre and I live in Berkeley, California. Last fall, I watched a virtual reality program that took me inside what it's like to be in a pig factory farm. And it was incredibly powerful, and it's made me a committed animal rights activist and, going forward, a lifelong vegan. There was really nothing like the experience of feeling immersed in the environment. And aside from the smells, which were being described by the people actually doing the filming, it really felt like I was there, I think.
Deirdre, thanks very much for sharing your story. And Professor, you talk about how some VR experiences are used to create greater social consciousness of things like animal welfare or how we use water.
Look, the title of the book is Experience on Demand, and the caller just epitomized, if there's one takeaway, don't think of VR as a media experience. The brain tends to treat it as an actual one. So if you don't want to stop eating meat, then don't visit a virtual slaughterhouse. In other words, if visiting a physical slaughterhouse would change your attitude towards meat, if you do it in VR, my bet would be, and based on some of our data, because we've had people literally walk on all fours and become cows in VR, it changes the way you think about all sorts of things. And so think of VR as an actual experience, not a media experience, and that will help guide what you choose to do and what you choose to avoid.
To that end, I wonder if you could talk briefly about VR and kids. I know when I turn on my PlayStation VR system, there's an advisory about kids younger than, I think, 13, 12 or 13, using a VR headset. What should parents know about letting their children use virtual reality?
So I just published, I co-authored with three other great scholars, a free piece online from Common Sense Media. It's called VR 101, and it literally is a 50-page answer to your question there. The two takeaways for parents are moderation and supervision. Moderation meaning, you know, for young kids, so I've got a six-year-old and a four-year-old, and my six-year-old has done VR four or five times in her life, about 2 minutes a pop each time. So that's my definition of moderation for my kids. And supervision. And supervision in this instance is not just make sure they're not watching content you're not comfortable with, but make sure they don't smash into walls.
And it's also worth noting, I think there are lots of VR games you can play sitting down, and also VR games that you can play as a group. Like there are party games, for example, where one person wears the headset, everyone else wears a controller. So you as a parent, you can be watching on the TV and know exactly what your kid is doing in real time.
Yeah, I'm gonna urge parents to be in the same room as their kids when they're using VR. I personally, and I've been doing VR for 20 years, while sitting down, sometimes I get so engaged in VR, I lean down really quickly to see something on the floor and I smash my face against the desk. I've done that last week. VR needs supervision. This is the catch-22 here, which is that it's so compelling. You just have no idea where you are and you just are so engaged with the content. However, there is a physical room with sharp objects, and that's the parents, please supervise. Don't trust the TV.
We got some stories from you about how VR had a profound emotional impact on you, including this message left in our inbox.
My name's Richard. I'm calling from Tampa. I had recently purchased one of the new Samsung Galaxy phones and for a birthday present got the DVR glasses. I put them on and chose to take a virtual trip of New York City, which was my wife and my favorite city, and she has just recently passed away from cancer. And I visited the Top of the Rock virtually, and the last time I had visited Top of the Rock was with my wife, and instantly I was transformed to the Top of the Rock, and it took my breath away. And I hadn't been there since I had been there with my wife, and it was so realistic with the sounds and the views that I started to cry inside my DVR glasses.
Wow. Richard, I appreciate you being willing to share your story with us. Thank you so much. Jeremy, what about VR and dealing with trauma?
I mean, the story is, you know, I thank you for sharing that story. And this is why VR works to treat post-traumatic stress disorder. VR creates an experience that the brain treats as if it were real, for the most part, when we look at the neuroscience of it. Now, people that have got PTSD, the way you treat that typically is something called cognitive exposure therapy. And in the book, I interview Joanne DeFede, who treated first responders from 9/11, and Skip Rizzo, who treats veterans coming back from the Middle East. And when you treat those patients, when therapists treat those patients, normally they try to get them with imagination to go back to the trauma, try to imagine what it was like during that trauma so that they can then give you coping strategies and undo bad associations to help you get better in the real world. The problem is if most people don't want to go back to that trauma because it's traumatic.
Right.
What VR does is it takes away that brutal process of imagining you were there and just puts you there. Now, both Skip and Joanne would say very clearly this should be done with a therapist present. So the therapist use VR as a tool to help the therapy, but there's great data showing this works. The tragedy, in my mind, is that there's so many academic studies that indicate that VR can help those who have had trauma, yet most people who go to the hospitals, go to doctors, they don't get VR as an option. It has not yet entered this kind of zeitgeist of insurance reimbursement and other aspects. So I know I'm talking to Washington, D.C., so decision makers, please work on this.
For someone who's interested in starting in VR, where's a good place to start?
Again, I before you buy a system at home, because great VR is hard, you've got to calibrate the cameras, you've got to worry about driver updates, go to a virtual reality arcade where they've got it set up and try it. There's many of them, most major cities. I know D.C. has a few, and most major cities have them.
Professor Jeremy Bailenson directs Stanford's Virtual Human Interaction Lab. His new book is called Experience on Demand, What Virtual Reality Is, How It Works, and What It Can Do. Professor, thanks for talking to us.
It is fantastic. Thank you, Joshua.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.